This is a Wisconsin Public Radio special presentation. Forever Ace, the Richard Boggs story.
Racing with the moon, high up in the midnight blue.
I'm Jim Packard. Between December 1942 and December 1944, U.S. Army Air Corps fighter pilot Richard Boggs shot down 40 enemy aircraft, more than any American pilot in World War II or any United States conflict. This is his story as told by his family, friends, and colleagues. Standing next to a never-built runway on what was to be a fighter jet interceptor base 40 miles south of Milwaukee, Boggs State Recreation Area Park Manager John Meyer said this Cold War project is now a place to play. The base was to protect the Milwaukee-Chicago area from Soviet attack, but was canceled in 1959, leaving an unfinished runway 2.5 miles long with a painted white X on it.
X marks the spot. This is the westernmost portion of the runway. They never did put the concrete on the runway. The rumor is that the project was canceled about 3 days prior to them bringing in the concrete trucks.
The X lets pilots know it isn't an active runway. The Boggs Recreation Area is a 7-square-mile state park with open space, trees, marshland, and plenty of frogs. Meyer calls it one big happy playground where people can fly model planes and hot air balloons. They even have a model rocket launch event each May. Meyer says a lot of people don't know the story of Major Richard Boggs, the farm boy from Poplar, Wisconsin, who led all U.S. fighter pilots in kills in World War II. Even so, he says pilots treat the area with curiosity.
I think every pilot who probably starts flying in this area wants to fly over the air base just to kind of see what was going to be once an Air Force base and pick up the history. And I talk to many people who are local pilots, and they will commonly say, oh yeah, I made sure I had to fly over and take a look at that and look at those X's on the runway and look at what used to be or what was going to be that air base out there.
The park features nature programs and outdoor recreation. Edward Seaton is a hang glider from Chicago. He's heard good things about the park, but doesn't know much about its namesake.
I know that he was a pilot, and I think that he flew in World War II, but that's about all I know. That's all I know. Basically, that's the only reason I know that is because I walked by a picture that kind of made me think World War II.
This is the first sortie, before the war.
When whippoorwills call and evening is nigh, I hurry to my blue heaven. A turn to the right, a little white light will lead you to my blue heaven. You'll see a smiling face, a fireplace, a cozy room, a little nest that's nestled where the roses bloom. Just Molly and me, and baby makes three. We're happy in my blue heaven.
There was nothing that would portend national hero in Richard Ira Bong, but there was a lot that made him a good guy and a popular kid. That's the way Marvin Peterson sees it. He was Bong's best friend growing up in Poplar. No one figured he'd be a war hero someday.
Well, not back in those days, of course. We were just strictly small-town people, and whatever he did try to do well. I mean,
Peterson and Dick Bong went to the same church, the same 4-H club, the same school, and to the state teacher's college in nearby Superior. He says his buddy liked to play baseball, sang in the church choir, and played the cornet. But mostly, someday he wanted to fly.
He was interested in building model airplanes and that type of thing. Any flying was a big event back in those days. It was not the common thing that we think of today. And any time an airplane came near our town, why, it was quite an event. If it sometimes it landed in a hayfield out in back of our school, and sometimes just went over, but it was a big event.
Dick Bong was 7 years old when President Calvin Coolidge made Superior, Wisconsin, the summer White House in 1928. Coolidge liked to fish, and the world-renowned Brule River, loaded with brown and brook trout, was less than an hour from Superior. Bong's younger sisters, Jerry and Joyce, he had six sisters and two brothers, remember that twice a day a plane would fly over the Bong family farm, carrying mail and official correspondence for the president.
When we were out there playing, all of a sudden here'd come this plane overhead. And of course, everybody, you didn't see an airplane very often, so everybody was ran yelling, "Airplane, airplane," because everybody got so excited when they saw one. And that was his plane that we saw, and that was...
And we run out every time yet and look, mm-hmm. If I hear a plane, you run out.
Planes were pretty exotic down on the farm. Sister Joyce Bong Erickson says farm life was demanding. Dick helped his dad, Carl, tend to the crops and took care of the cows and hogs.
Dick and Bud would have to take care of the barn work. I just remember school days. Nelda would be washing the dishes, and maybe Jerry, you made the lunches
school lunches.
Uh-huh. So Nelda's the oldest. We would, she would be washing the dishes. And, of course, we younger ones, had to wipe dishes and things like that. Of course, we had to get our beds made before we went to school and so on. So, of course, you got home from school, and there were beans to pick or potatoes to pick or... There was always something to do, work to be done. Yeah.
Speaking in a 2004 interview in the same farmhouse where she grew up, Joyce and Sister Jerry sat in the living room just downstairs from the bedroom where Dick shared a bed with Brother Bud. Surrounded by family pictures, Jerry said the hard work and devotion necessary to life on a family farm shaped Dick Bong.
He loved his flying, I had to put it that way, and he was good at it. As far as on the farm, yes, everybody worked hard on the farm. There's no doubt. We all had our own jobs to do, and we learned what's right from wrong.
It was his job to do, I guess, so he did it.
But after the chores were done, Jerry says her brother's attention turned to aviation, as much as it could for a kid.
He and his friend Roger Robinson used to spend a lot of time here making those little paper airplanes, they had used balsa wood. And they used a razor blade, and they cut these little tiny pieces out, and then they glued them together, and then they put, like, tissue paper to fill in the skin over the plane. Then they used rubber binders to twist the prop up, and they'd go out in the yard to fly them, and they might fly once and they'd crash and they'd have to start over again and see if they could pierce them up, but they did that a lot. And some of their planes were with wingspans about like 2 feet long, probably more than that, some of them.
The boy who built balsa wood model planes and chased the president's mail plane with his barking dog Speaks had a lofty goal, to fly. In 1941, he enlisted in the Army Air Corps Aviation Cadet Program. Joyce Bong Erickson said while it was a way to serve his country, he wasn't trying to be particularly noble.
I don't know about the patriotic duty. I don't think any of the kids were really thinking that because they weren't in war yet. He just figured this could happen and something that if he wanted to be where he wanted to be, he had to do it that way.
This is the second sortie. The war begins for America.
The first shot of World War II against the Japanese by the United States came at 6:40 a.m., December 7th, 1941, about a mile outside of the shelter of Pearl Harbor. The destroyer USS Ward fired those shots more than an hour before the Japanese attacked the naval and air bases in Hawaii. Naval fireman Willette Lerner was on the Ward and a witness to history when they fired on a Japanese two-man submarine near the entrance to Pearl.
We had fired at it. The first shot missed it, went over the conning tower. Second shot hit it right in the conning tower. I saw it when it got hit. I saw it when it was going down and went underneath our ship. We weren't 50 yards from it when it was hit.
In a 2004 interview with Wisconsin Public Radio, Lerner said shooting wasn't an easy decision for Captain William Outerbridge. They couldn't identify the mini-sub as it ran on the surface, but they did know it was in restricted waters.
The skipper was a new skipper, had just come aboard the day 2 days before that. He said, my job is to sink anything that's out here that's not supposed to be. And he says, if it's one of ours, it'll be the shortest command I ever had. But he says, we got to sink it. And we did sink it.
The Ward radioed that they'd sunk an unidentified submarine. Still no alert sounded to the ships moored in the harbor. As it turned out, moored like sitting ducks. An hour and 20 minutes later, the infamous sneak attack on Pearl Harbor thrust the U.S. into the Second World War.
Oh, yes, we saw it. We saw all the planes diving and such, but we didn't know what was going on. At first, we thought it was practice, you know, the Air Force practicing. But then when a couple of planes came over us and dropped bombs alongside the ship and we could see the red ball on it, then we knew it was Japanese and then we knew what was going on. There was a lot of smoke and explosions and that, and we didn't really think that that was common.
A native of St. Paul who moved to Stevens Point, Lerner says it's still frustrating that Pearl Harbor wasn't put on alert.
They wanted verification of it. How do you verify anything when it's down on the bottom?
In fact, verification didn't come for another 61 years. In 2002, a University of Hawaii expedition located the mini-sub 1,200 feet on the ocean bottom, right where the Ward's captain radioed it would be.
The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and airfields at Ford Island, Hickam, Bellows, and Wheeler were the explosive culmination of long simmering tensions between the United States and Japan. The U.S. objected to Japan's so-called Great East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. That was the Nippon Empire's excuse to invade Korea, China, and Indochina, dating back to its invasion of Manchuria in 1931. Colonel Mark Wells is the chairman of the U.S. Air Force Academy's History Department. He says war with Japan wasn't a sure thing. Still, an attack on the largest naval base in the Pacific at Pearl Harbor was hard to imagine.
It's fair to say that the attack itself came as a surprise and a deep shock. And then certainly within just a few hours, the attack on the Philippines, but for many people in government, if the attack itself at a tactical level was a huge surprise, there was no great surprise that eventually the two nations had found themselves at war.
In a battle planned and led by Imperial Navy Commander Isoroku Yamamoto, 7 of 8 U.S. battleships were sunk in what President Franklin Roosevelt called a date which will live in infamy. Wells says heavy naval losses marked the darkest days of the war.
We underestimated the Japanese. Just to be very direct, there was an element of racism. We thought that these were Japanese, after all, and somehow that we would prevail rather more easily. And yet, the Japanese pretty much ran wild for 6 months or so in the Pacific, took a whole series of islands and extended this perimeter way out. Wake Island fell, the Philippines fell, Bataan and Corregidor. It was just one American and Allied defeat after another. The British in Malaya and Singapore fell, and Australia threatened. So we quickly began to understand that this was no easy enemy to overcome. When we actually sort of came face-to-face with them, they quickly dissuaded us of any sort of racist notions that they were inferior, you know, the caricatures of Japanese is short, you know, with bad eyesight and buck tooth and all of that stuff. You see these characters all the time in the late 1930s and early 1940s in Life and Time magazine. So the Japanese gave us everything we could handle for the first 6 months, and the road back would be very long.
Along with crippled naval power, Wells says American air power in the Pacific was hit hard. He says the Japanese had better planes and better pilots.
Japanese pilots had been flying and fighting in China. They were extraordinarily elite with thousands of flying hours. They're called the Sea Eagles, and these guys were virtuosos. And, of course, you've heard about Japanese Zeros and the excellence of that airplane. And our airplanes were, even by the start of the war in the Pacific, relatively obsolete. The Brewster Buffalo and the Grumman F-4F Wildcat was slightly better. The P-40s of Flying Tiger fame in China were inferior and had to be skillfully used to keep from being shot down. Anyway, our pilots got better and better, sort of the crucible of combat. And as the training programs in the United States ramped up, and we were able to send people to the South Pacific, then they got better.
In the days that followed the attacks on Hawaii and Southeast Asia, the Japanese fears expanded quickly, closing in on Australia. Australian War Museum historian Dr. Carl James says the low point was an air raid on Darwin in early 1942.
There was certainly some fear, and a justifiable fear and concern in a lot of quarters, a lot of resolve as well. The Australian population, the Australian industry and home front were mobilised for war in a way which we've never been mobilised before, ever, or ever since, really. Introduced the conscription to fight in the islands and also to defend the Australian mainland. So there's a lot of concern and worry.
James says Australia braced for a Japanese attack by building makeshift airfields in the jungle in early 1942 as the first American soldiers, pilots, and sailors arrived.
In those early days, it was very primitive, just kind of strips, cut into a jungle, a bit of around Darwin, just bulldozers through the desert type of thing. Very primitive, very basic. And it was really because Australia didn't have the capacity to help defend itself against a major enemy threat before 1942, and with the arrival of American forces, these were just more troops in Australia than we'd ever seen before, and more equipment as well. That's the big thing from Australia, a large number of soldiers, a large number of airmen, and also just massive amount of technology, tanks, vehicles, and aircraft.
The GIs joined their Australian soldier counterparts, who were nicknamed diggers for their trench digging in the First World War. James says the 7 million people of Australia welcomed the GIs, at least most of them did.
A lot of Australian homes welcomed up their family, well, welcomed up their homes to American servicemen. They were billeted. Australian women certainly loved the GIs, had nice-looking uniforms. They were paid better than Australian soldiers. They had access to things like silk stockings. And they did these funny things too. When American GIs went out with Australian girls, they used to give them flowers and chocolates. And from the Australian diggers who'd fought in the Middle East, this is completely unheard of. And so there was an element of tension which did come into things. That's more just normal masculine rivalry or jealousy, really, because the Australian girls seem to go for the American GIs rather than the Australian diggers.
Just as the British would say as U.S. forces built up for the invasion of Europe from Great Britain, Aussie diggers thought GIs were overpaid, oversexed, and overhere. But James says Allied air and naval power joining with Australian forces were pivotal in holding off a Japanese juggernaut that seemed unstoppable as it overran neighboring New Guinea and New Britain. The alliance was embraced by Australian Prime Minister John Curtin.
Curtin had the vision to look to and appreciate how important the United States would be as a military alliance in the Pacific War. Curtin really looked towards the U.S. and realized that we couldn't be able to fight without the support of the United States.
James says the GIs and diggers had more to deal with than Japanese Zeros. They had to fight the jungles of Australia and New Guinea.
I'm sure it's all matter of snakes, creatures, and insects that most senior servicemen from Midwest would not be used to at all. Actually, most Australians who come from sort of Sydney and Melbourne, the southern states, when they went to north, up north, freaked them out as well.
Spiders and snakes and crocs aside, Air Force Academy historian Mark Wells says Japanese forces gave the Allies everything they could handle in the first half of 1942. Then in May 1942 came the fierce naval and air battle of the Coral Sea between Port Moresby, New Guinea, and Brisbane, Australia.
We now have a major naval engagement where it's notable for two reasons. One is the first time you have two substantial surface fleets who actually don't sight each other. All the combat is conducted by carrier-borne aviation. The losses pretty much even, we say, on either side. We lost a carrier, the Japanese lost a light carrier, but strategically the Japanese, they were worried enough that they didn't continue south towards Australia, so that's why Coral Sea is important.
Then came the Battle of the Midway Islands on June 4th. If Midway didn't hold, the nearest U.S. base would be pushed back to Pearl Harbor.
It's clearly a huge battle. Up to Midway, the Japanese are on the offensive almost everywhere. We're scrambling to try to stop them. Midway stopped their advance. So the Japanese high water mark was stopped at Midway.
In August, the Battle of Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands was the first Allied offensive in the South Pacific. The battle raged for months and set the stage for the island-hopping march northward. Wells says small, unknown atolls became key airstrips so fighters and bomber pilots could assault Japanese ground troops and ships. Wells said the strategy was to advance the bomber line.
There's no intrinsic value whatsoever in a small 245-acre atoll called Tarawa that's worth 6,000 dead Marines. But it has an airfield on it, and that airfield then can bring further Japanese forces under attack. And so the Marines and the Navy expend that kind of blood and energy to take an island to put a base on it where big bombers and airplanes can be used to attack other places.
Listening to Forever Ace, the Richard Bong story on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the third sortie. As second lieutenant, Bong entered the Southwest Pacific Theater in late 1942. Japan held a 15,000-mile perimeter. In her book, History of World War II, author Anne Woodward Miller writes that every island in that circle was occupied by Japanese forces. Lieutenant General George Churchill Kenny led the 5th Air Force in the South Pacific. Anne Woodward Miller called Kenny 5'6" of dynamic fighting man. A veteran of the First World War, his heroism in Europe earned him the Distinguished Service Cross and a scarred face. In 1922, Kenny was the first to put guns on the wings of a plane. In the South Pacific, his strategy concentrated on fighter planes to destroy enemy plane cover and then destroy the ships and troops. In the next segment, the derogatory version of Japanese is used, which was common during that time but may be offensive to some listeners.
Bong began in the Air Corps as a flying cadet in early 1941. Stateside training lasted more than a year. Chomping at the bit to see some action, he was shipped out from Hamilton Field near San Francisco to a jungle airdrome outside of Port Moresby, New Guinea, in the fall of 1942. The job of the 39th Squadron was to patrol and harass the enemy as the Japanese tried to reinforce its bases in the Bunagona area near Port Moresby. Bong's crew chief was Elwood Barden, a southern boy from Alabama. They were both 22 years old, green, and hoping for action.
When he first came on my plane, I was probably an old man about, I might have been 22. I know I was 21 when the Japanese gave me a birthday present. They sent over about 27 Betty bombers. That was my birthday present. But anyhow, he just looked like a baby kid when he come and got in that airplane.
After several uneventful patrols, Second Lieutenant Bong got his wish to see action. On December 27, 1942, Captain Tommy Lynch led a patrol of four P-38s with Bong as his wingman. They were told that 40 enemy planes were in the Buna area. More P-38s were dispatched, but Lynch led his group into what Bong described as a screaming dive into the formation of Zeros and bombers. In his book, America's Ace of Aces, The Dick Bong Story, Carl Bong writes that a Zero was on his brother's tail, so he dove his P-38 to what Dick Bong described as 2 inches above the shortest tree in the Buna area. As he leveled off, an Imperial dive bomber was in front of him. He gave a short burst from his 50-caliber guns and said the bomber blew higher than a kite. Then out of the corner of his eye, he saw a Zero coming into his line of fire. Another burst, and the Zero expired in the middle of his sights. On December 27, 1942, Bong got his first 2 kills. In 2 weeks, he'd shoot down 3 more, giving him the minimum number of kills to become an American ace. It wasn't easy being crew chief for a fighter pilot in the South Pacific jungles. Sergeant Elwood Barden of Mobile, Alabama, was crew chief for Bong in Dobadura, New Guinea.
You had to do a lot of things over there that over here you could just get parts and change them. Over there we had to take parts and work them and put them back together and get them going like that, especially in the hydraulic systems of the planes. It took lots of long hours. I mean, we worked round the clock, if necessary, to keep them going. One time he came in, you know, the crew chiefs always jumped up on the airplane, won't know if they made contact or anything like that. So I jumped up there on the wing and said, "Well, Major, did you do anything?" He said, "Yeah, I think I got 4, but says, "You might better check my tail section back there. I think I got hit." I went back there on the left side of that boom, and the ailerons was almost shot off.
Barton said each fighter pilot had a ground crew that kept the engine running, the radio working, and the guns firing. There was even a sheet metal guy who plugged the bullet holes. 1942 and 1943 were the most dangerous years.
See, the ground forces were right ahead of us all the time. In fact, we had some crazy jokers in our outfit that just thrived on stuff like that, and they would sneak off at night and go with scouts, you know, to scout out the enemy. I had one old boy from Texas particularly that done this. They were right ahead of us. In fact, the scouts were still on the ground up ahead of us when we go in. The engineers would put us down a landing field, and we would go in and start operating.
There were no roads, just native trails. Ralph Wandry was Bong's wingman. In a 2003 interview, Dobadura was still fresh in Wandry's memory. A grass strip 10,000 feet long on Buna Plantation, the only flatland for miles. It was between a 13,000-foot-high mountain range and the jungle.
Behind us was the swamp and the rainforest, which our camp was located in. This was about, 12 miles deep. And it was inhabited by 20-foot crocodiles and 22 and longer foot pythons. Not a good place to go down. And on the right was the Pacific Ocean. 2 miles ahead of our airplanes where we parked them were the Japs' front lines. I spent the first 4 months, we didn't fly an offensive mission. We just tried to keep the Japanese from blowing us off the face of the earth. This was Dobadura.
Bong's fame grew, shooting down 21 Zeros, Oscars, Zeeks, Bettys, and Dinas, the masculine names for fighter planes, the feminine names for bombers. Wandry says stories grew taller, including one that Bong killed a crocodile to save a fellow pilot who crash-landed.
We lost a pilot in the swamp behind the deal, and he could hear the airplanes warm up every morning. He was hanging in a parachute. It took 3 days for the Australians to get in there and rescue him with rubber rafts. And as they were coming out, there was a 20-foot crocodile following the raft. Bong was circling there, and he was going to strafe the crocodile. And wisely, he decided, well, if any of these bullets ricochet and sink the raft, we're not going to do any good or anything. But he kept going until they got out of the way and lost the croc. But that's one of the deals that didn't happen, but it made a good story, and they built it up in the magazine that they put out then.
Army Air Corps pilot Walter Markey met Bong at a tactical training unit in San Francisco in August 1942. Their mission was to defend the city against a Japanese air attack, but that mission changed. Markey and Bong were among a dozen pilots who were ordered to Australia and fly P-38 Lightning fighter planes to support ships and bombers. Markey says those early days were marked by short supplies and rations that weren't very good eating.
What support we could build up on the home front went to Europe. The troops in Australia and New Guinea just had to make do with what, had to fight a holding battle is basically what all was being looked for at that point in time.
Markey and Bong were tent mates. They were assigned to airstrips in Australia, then to the northern coast of New Guinea and the Schwimmer Aerodrome, and then Dobadura. He says their planes were the only thing keeping Japanese troops from resuming attacks on Australia.
The Owen Stanley, the mountain range that ran down the spine of New Guinea, was their impediment to being able to go any further. If they got the other coast of New Guinea, why, they would have had a jumping-off point for Australia.
Markey says in their first few months, they flew defensive missions over places a popular farm boy or a Brooklyn tough guy like him never heard of. The Huon Gulf, Milne Bay, Banya Banya, New Guinea, and the Bismarck Sea.
So we didn't have that much engagement at all times with Japanese aircraft. On a few occasions, half a dozen maybe, they came over on bombing missions, and there'd be an engagement. In the latter stages of 43, we would go on to aggressive missions on Rabaul or Wewak. We'd become engaged with Japanese protective forces. But other than a monthly strike by Washing Machine Charlie that came over in the full moon and dropped a stick of bombs on New Guinea, why, they didn't have any sustained effort.
It was a time when a bunch of young, single, inexperienced flyers faced battle-sharpened Japanese flyers. The experience earned wingman Ralph Wandry the nickname Iron Pants. Wandry says his P-38 was shot up during a raid on the New Guinea Japanese naval and air fortress at Rabaul. He got back to Dobo, but crash-landed.
Then I caught a ride back into camp. Well, Dick was sitting at the table in the mess hall eating, and I walked in, and I saw the color just drain out of his face when he looked up. And he said, "Wandry, what in the heck are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I came here to eat. What are you thinking?" He said, "Well, we saw you crash and burn at the end of the strip." I said, "Well, that was my plane, but," I said, "it wasn't me. I'm like a bad penny. I come back all the time." And he said, "Well, we stopped at the tower, and we asked them, you know, the guy in the tower was watching through binoculars, and he said nobody got out of that plane." And I said, "Well, I hate to disappoint you, but here I am, and I'm hungry." And he said, "Well, I suppose you want your jacket back then." And I looked, and here was R.H. Wandry on the jacket there. They had already divided up all my clothes.
Iron Pants Wandry came out of that crash with a scratched elbow that required some ointment.
"I'm gonna buy a paper doll that I can call my own. A doll that other fellows cannot steal. And then the flirty, flirty guys with their flirty, flirty eyes will have to flirt with dollies that are real. When I come home at night, she will be waiting. She'll be the truest doll in all this world. I'd rather have a paper doll to call single-minded real-life girl.
This is Sortie 4. First leave, a hero's welcome.
Thanks, folks. Thanks. Those were the words of Captain Richard Bone to the throngs that greeted him at his parents' home in Poplar at 1 o'clock this morning. The Army's leading fighter ace is home for the first time since May of 1941, flying from combat action in New Guinea on an 8-day trip that ended on the back porch of the family farm. It was an emotional homecoming, but it was also an exhausting journey from the other side of the globe. Captain Bong flew from New Guinea to San Francisco, then to Chicago, where he caught a train to Milwaukee. From there, he hitched a car ride with Milwaukee Journal reporter Harvey Schwander, with Captain Bong driving the final 100 miles himself, narrowly missing deer while driving through Wascott and Spooner. It's clear that he's out of touch. He heard Paper Doll for the first time on the radio during the drive north. Superior Evening Telegram reporter Ralph Mason was one of the many reporters on hand to cover Captain Bong's arrival. Good evening, Ralph.
Good evening, Lou. People started gathering at the Bong farmhouse after the supper hour, including members from the American Legion and the Army Air Corps Superior State Teachers College 29-piece band. Perhaps the most reserved was Dad. That's Carl Bong. He sat in his favorite chair, clad in red plaid shirt, woolen breeches, and slippers, telling stories of putting up this year's hay crop and past hunting trips in Wisconsin's north woods. Dick's mom, Dora, did not try to hide her excitement. She spent the evening telling Sonny stories, how he fell off the swing at school when he was 12 and broke his arm, how he tipped over the tractor at 16, how he excelled at baseball and hockey. Captain Bong's 17-year-old brother Bud spent much of the night lining up things for their hunting trip later this week, including repairing snowshoes. Little Jimmy, just 4 years old, greatly added to his collection of photographer's flashbulbs. He caught occasional catnaps on his grandmother Bryce's lap, while the family dog, Speak, sniffed the strangers. 21-year-old sister Nelda played the piano and had a sing-along, including the Glenn Miller hit Elmer's Tune. American Legion Post Commander Charles Cadigan and R.J. Ellenson brought hunting boots from the Boots for Bongs campaign. By 1:15, the farmhouse was bulging with well-wishers.
Why are the stars always winking and blinking above? What makes a fella start thinking of falling in love? It's not the season, the reason is plain as the moon. It's just Elmer's tune. What makes a lady of 80 go out on the loose? Why does a gander meander in search of a goose? What puts the kick in a chicken, the magic in June? It's just Elmer's tune. Listen, listen, there's a lot you're liable to be missing. Sing it, swing it, any old way and any old time. The hurdy-gurdy's the birdies, the cop on the beat, the candy maker, the baker, the man on the street. The city charmer, the farmer, the man in the moon, I'll sing Elmer's tune. City charmer, the farmer, the man in the moon. All sing Elmer's tune, they all sing Elmer's tune, they all sing Elmer's tune, sing Elmer's tune.
On November 17th, 1943, only days from the jungles of the Southwest Pacific, Captain Richard Bong was home in northern Wisconsin, arriving late at night on the heels of a winter storm. Sisters Jerry and Joyce remember the farmhouse was packed.
Oh, my. How many were here from the college themselves? How many professors?
Air cadets were stationed in Superior going to college, and they had a band. They were here in the house. I don't know how many pieces there were. 15, 20
no,
or whatever.
Yeah, but there were a lot of them, yeah. I would say
and
easily
and then there
15,
were representatives from the Legion
alone.
And from the vets and from the newspapers and all of us. And I don't know how many there were. I would suppose 50, 60 people anyhow.
There were a lot of people.
With 21 enemy kills to his credit in less than a year of combat, Captain Bong was one of America's top three aces, along with Marine pilots Smokey Joe Foss and Pappy Boyington. So everyone wanted a piece of the new war hero, their war hero. He had become a national symbol to a nation in need of heroes. Reporters and photographers vied for stories and pictures. Local dignitaries wanted him to make speeches and be at their head table. There was even a local Boots for Bong drive to get him a pair of winter boots so he could go hunting. Since rubber was rationed, it nearly took an act of Congress to get the boots. Northern Wisconsin Congressman Alvin O.K. Okonski delivered. Bong got his boots. Amidst the hubbub, a group of co-eds from Superior State wanted him to crown the king and queen at their homecoming dance. Mary Gray was one of a group of six Lambda Sigma Lambda sorority sisters hoping to land the big catch. In fact, Gray and her pals were themselves quite a catch.
I'm trying to think what it was called, and we didn't call it that, really. But someone just in fun mentioned it one time in our group, you know, scintillating six. So you can see why we didn't say it about ourselves.
Scintillating was a bit racy for 1943 northern Wisconsin. Still, Gray and reigning homecoming queen Marjorie Vattendall reeled in their hero. Vattendall said Dick Bong promised to be at the dance.
When he walked into the gymnasium where the thing was taking place, you could just hear, I called it like the buzzing of blue flies, you could just hear this murmur. You know, there he is, there he is.
Vattendall says the plan was for Bong to crown the king, and she would pass on her crown to the queen.
He didn't seem to be listening to me at all, you know. I was getting a little annoyed because, I mean, he was so happy to be home, you know, to be surrounded by his family and friends. He and Pete were poking each other, you know, and acting like real troublemakers as far as I was concerned. Well, come the time for him to do it, he did everything that he was supposed to do, and I was so nervous. I just flubbed everything, but it was fun.
Not only was Bong a war hero, but at 23 years old, he was a college-age man. Both were rare on the home front during the war years. But the problem was, he wouldn't dance. So effortless and graceful in the sky, the earthbound Bong had never learned to dance. Vattendall figured that was that. Even a member of the scintillating six couldn't get the fearless fighter ace to give dancing a try. But in fact, the story was only beginning. After the dance, Vattendall and her friend Margie Flynn went to Chef's Restaurant for ice cream. So did Dick Bong.
It was crowded, and from a back booth, Richard had spotted us. Because I'm so tall, I always stand over everybody, so I was not hard to pick up. So he waved like this, and Margie and I dashed over there and sat down. We talked about that evening's event. Meanwhile, people are coming up and asking for his autograph.
While he didn't like the attention, he did like the company. So did she.
Because he, like so many of the fellows there, were just, his words, just doing our job so they could get home. He was a very skilled pilot. You know, he had great vision, and he just did his job under extreme perilous conditions. When you read about what he did, flying straight into a plane, firing, you know, when you think of that, it gives you goosebumps.
Did you think it would be that way, that night, that something really clicked between you two?
Who can tell something like that? I mean, I was immediately attracted to him because he was really two sides to him. With the press, he was always, yes, no, I don't want to talk about that. But among his friends, he was very relaxed, has a wonderful sense of humor, loved to sing. Besides that, he was just darn cute.
For the rest of his leave, Dick and Marge were an item. She says they went to a lot of movies and just spent time together.
I learned how to bowl. It was a complete fiasco because half of the time I would drop the ball and back. And when I finally got it going down, it was more than one gutter ball, I can tell you that. But he taught me how to throw a curveball. And I really got pretty good at it. In fact, I think I beat him in a couple of games, which was something quite wonderful.
How did he take that?
Oh, well, maybe he made it happen. I don't know.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I got a gal in Kalamazoo. Don't want to boast, but I know she's the toast of Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo. Years have gone by. My, my, how she grew. I liked her looks when I carried her books in Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo. I'm gonna send a wire, hopping on a flight, leaving today. Am I dreaming? I can hear her screaming. Hiya, Mr. Jackson. Everything's okay. K-A-L-A-M-A-C-O. Oh, what a gal. A real pimperoo. I'll make my bed for that freckle-faced kid I'm hurrying to. I'm going to Michigan to see the sweetest girl in Kalamazoo.
Bong went to Washington, raised money for war bonds, and returned to a send-off parade in Superior. By February 1944, he was shipped off once more to the Southwest Pacific Theater and the 5th Air Force.
I'm glad to be going back into action again. I always did like shooting birds, and there isn't much different in shooting buzzards, except that these buzzards shoot back.